VicAss is brought to you by people like yourselves that are going to patreon.com, patreon.com/thefitcast. And there you can support the show starting at just $1 per episode. And with that $1 per episode, I'm going to make sure new episodes get produced every single week and out to your iTunes feeds. Everyone that is supporting the show through Patreon is actually getting the show 1 week early. So if you're jumping on there and supporting the show, you're going to get those episodes a week early and without any pre-roll stuff. It just goes right into the show. As we go into the new year, I just want to really say thank you to everyone that has been supporting the show. And also, if you can, if you thought about it, I would love if you could help out going forward, just because we've had some people drop off. And if you're concerned, you can always cancel your contribution anytime. But really, like I said, if you've been listening to the show for a long time, I'd really appreciate you, you know, giving back and hopefully helping out with the show. Like I said, really for about $4 a month, you can make sure that the show keeps going. And that's less than a standard cup of your famous brand coffee, which I don't want to throw under the bus. So thank you, as always, to people that are supporting the show. And it's super easy to do. Like I said, you just go to there, patreon.com/thefitcast. Use your credit card, and you can even support the show through PayPal. If you go to thefitcast.com, there's a PayPal tab on the left-hand side. Any bit, you know, it would be greatly appreciated. But like I said, I would hope you guys will help us out going forward and making sure great new people come to you every single week to answer your fitness, nutrition, rehab questions, things like that. So thank you for me, Kevin Larrabee. And without further ado, let's get into the show. Hello, welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 318, and I am back again with Michael Mullen to talk about all sorts of things. But we had an episode. It's hard to imagine that this was actually before I went to Japan, and now I'm back from Japan. But we recorded that before that. I had a wedding and all that stuff to go to, and then we talked about PRI for about an hour, just like really basic intro stuff, and we Mike did his best to kind of break it down and make it as simple as possible, because this is audio. This is not a seminar or anything like that, but did a great job. We got great response. So Mike, thanks for taking the time to come back on and, you know, talk a little bit more about this stuff.
Oh, absolutely, Kevin. Always fun to come on a FitCast. You guys do great work. So thanks for having me back on.
And we're lucky it's getting close to that time where the snow's going to be coming down and you're up in Maine. And luckily, with technology today, cell phones are still good to go. And there's no problems with losing electricity or phone lines or anything like that. But all joking aside, like I said, we got a great response from that first episode. And it was really just like a brief introduction to the concepts. And really, it felt like we almost didn't get into a lot of the concepts and the, you know, philosophy of PRI too much, because it was just like the introduction of breathing, because that's the thing that a lot of people have just heard about is, you know, diaphragmatic breathing, and that's associated with PRI because they've heard, whether it's Cressy talk about it or Boyle talk about it or whoever, that has been their kind of foot into the door when it comes to the PRI stuff. But I hope today we can get a little bit more in depth. I hope everyone out there is ready and listening. Maybe hope you're, you know, taking some notes, or at least just get ready to go back and, you know, go over some of this audio again, because there's going to be a lot of stuff to go over. So where should we start, Mike? What do you think?
Well, I think maybe what I'll do is, it's actually always interesting when you go back and listen to yourself lecture, which is always an odd thing. It's like listening to yourself on an answering machine. You kind of pick up some stuff. And what I wanted to do was try and create as smooth a transition as I possibly could from what I spoke to last time into what we thought we would talk about today, Kevin. And actually, since that time, had a chance to even spend a little more time on FitCast and listen to some of your really quality interviews that you have on there. You have a great selection of people and some really quality information. And through some of that, I was able to kind of hear, you know, bits and pieces of people and how they discuss different aspects of breath training, or, you know, I would hear PRI come up periodically in some of the questions and answers, and it always does seem to kind of revolve and stem back towards the breathing component, which, as we discussed last time, is a really important part of what the Institute discusses. But the volume of information above and beyond that is really significant. So what I thought I'd do is I'd kind of build into the next components from the breath training and the diaphragmatic training and the asymmetry that we ended with last time, and talk a little bit more about some of the integration of the patterns of the way that the Institute assesses and evaluates things, the way that the systems work together to be able to kind of create a body that's able to move and function on this planet, with gravity playing such a strong role in how we do things. So I thought I'd kind of start along those lines and take it from there.
Perfect. Let's jump right into it.
So, you know, with respect, I thought actually I'm going to read this real quickly. You know, one of the things that the Postural Restoration Institute, actually what they call, what is posture? This is actually directly from their website. So this is a quote from Ron Hruska, again, who's the founder of the Institute. And it says, "A posture is a reflection of the position of many systems that are regulated, determined, and created through limited functional patterns. These patterns reflect our ability and inability to breathe, rotate, and rest symmetrically. Limited functional patterns refers to movement that is restricted in directions, planes, or normal boundaries of functional range as a result of improper joint, muscle, and mediastinum rest position." And by mediastinum, they're basically referring to thoracic and chest wall. "Function is therefore limited because soft tissue and osseous or bony restrictions prevent one from using muscles and joints in their normal range. Adaptation and compensation for these limitations require neuromotor encoding and hyperactivity of muscle that is placed in improper positions that exceed normal physiological length, or in positions that make them a mover or countermover in planes and directions that are not observed when one is in a neutral or more symmetrical state of rest. This compensatory activity and hyperactivity usually becomes dysynchronous in the accessory muscles of respiration and at the appendicular flexors and axial extensors, thus limiting functional rotation at the trunk and through the lumbopelvic femoral and cranial mandibular cervical complex." So certainly, I think, a much more in-depth, and I don't even use the word complex, definition of the way that one would look at the word posture. You know, we as a human being try to do whatever we possibly can to take principles and concepts and make them as simplified as possible. But the reality of the way that our system works is that it's incredibly complex. And there are just some things that almost aren't doing service to the way that our body works by not giving them due credit, by understanding and truly appreciating all of the different systems' interactions amongst each other and the role that compensation plays on our bodies. Compensation is a direct reflection of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a direct reflection of movement. And our system is going to do whatever it possibly can to try and allow itself to do what it has to do to manage the tasks at hand when we're dealing with gravity and hopefully movement, some more than others, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, since everything that we do will revolve around the fact that we have to breathe in order to be able to stand on this planet and to be able to function, the ability to be able to have this happen in as balanced a state as possible is critical. And that's what we discussed a lot last time. Airflow drives our nervous system. It does a massive influence on the ability of our nerves to be able to respond to situations. In a situation where someone who's standing up in front of, you know, 100 people to give a lecture who hasn't done much public speaking before, they get short of breath, they get tense, they get sweaty, and all of that rotates around each other.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it has to do with our body's ability to be able to be in a more comfortable situation. A job we've been doing for 20 years, we're really comfortable with it. We're in a routine. Or it's an activity we really like. We're on our bike, and we're really comfortable on our bike doing something. Our system, as a general rule, will be able to kind of manage that flow and that energy that's driving that nervous system much better because our body's able to adapt to it much better. That being said, when we don't have the ability to have that optimal respiration take place, and our body is trying to figure out how to go from one foot to the other when we're walking and when we're standing to move, then that's where compensation will begin to develop. What that big description was that I talked about before, that wonderful description that Ron described, was it's talking about how when your body is driven into one direction, and it's a fairly predictable direction that we'll talk about in just a little bit, based upon inherent orientation of muscle activity wanting to pull you a certain way, because every time you take an air in and inhale, it's pulling you and rotating you into a certain direction, then it's going to orient yourself that way. Then when you go to transfer your weight from one side to the other, or you're going to try and do an activity that's more intense, your body will have to compensate in order to make that other side be able to do the same task as well as it did on that opposite side. So if I'm having someone stand, if you can picture, if you will, which unfortunately, because this is a podcast, you'll hear me say a lot, imagine, if you will, someone standing and they have equal weight on both feet and their arms are just resting naturally at their side. Mm-hmm. As their body goes to inhale, the imbalance and the asymmetry in that respiratory system is going to be pulling our lower spine and pelvis towards the right. Mm-hmm. It's physiology. Some people, it's significant. Other people, not nearly as much. And that's where the assessments and the evaluations help to determine the degree of how much of a pull this has. So if every time I go to inhale and my pelvis and lumbar spine is being pulled to the right because of that stronger pull of that diaphragm on the right side, because it's thicker, because it's better positioned to work, because it's supported by other organs, because it attaches to three of our lumbar vertebrae on the right side and only two on the left side, each time it pulls us that way, then we're going to have to do something else to try and counter that activity, which is going to be rotate our upper body a little bit back towards that left side so that we can walk straight ahead. So with every inhalation pulling our pelvis and lumbar spine to the right, we're going to have a tendency to have a stronger orientation towards that side. So you can imagine if someone's standing in the very position that I talked about, if every time they inhale, they're being pulled onto the right side a little bit more, mm-hmm. as they go to do a task, like let's say walk or then run or do something along those lines, it's not going to be as well balanced for them to be able to do stuff onto that left side as they can onto the right side, because they're going to be constantly breathing as they go through that cycle of activity. Compensation develops because now we've got to do stuff where we have to be able to function. We got to lift and carry things in front of us. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to sit in a chair. We have to be able to, you know, go for a run or go for a walk, or we're planning on all of these things being able to happen evenly and in a balanced way from one side to the other. But it can't. It's continuing to pull us every time we go to inhale, and those muscles contract and pull us into that one side. Some people will compensate by over-rotating back to the left. Some people will overcompensate by overextending. That lordosis in their spine, in their lumbar spine and pelvis, will tip forward a little bit more to allow their body to be able to maneuver by that imbalance. They'll begin to torque their shoulders and their upper thorax a little bit. They'll rotate their head and their neck into a different direction. They'll have a tendency to roll towards one side of one ankle a little bit different than they'll roll towards the opposite ankle. Thus, again, further creating a dominance in that pattern or in that chain of muscles, mm-hmm. that is following a very predictable pattern of what's being driven by our airflow not being able to be equal side to side. So when the Institute discusses things such as patterns, they're referring to some very specific polyarticular muscle chains that the Institute has identified through a tremendous amount of research of muscles that are influenced by this imbalance. Now, polyarticular muscle chain means that it's a group of muscles that cross many joints and work kind of in synchrony, or at least should be working in some degree of synchrony with each other. So when, if you have a group of muscles, like when I go to, if I go to flex my arm and I contract my bicep, that's not the only muscle taking place. There's got to be other muscles helping out that process. Or let's use bench press. Kevin, since you love to bench press so much.
Of course, yeah. Let's bring
it up. It's not just, exactly. It's just not, it's not just a pec activity. You got a lot of other muscles that help have that process happen in a very coordinated fashion. The same type of thing with walking and with gait and with breathing. So when that diaphragm, which has very specific connections to our psoas, because of the attachment of that diaphragm down into that lumbar spine, right next to the attachment is the psoas muscle. Well, that is, that psoas goes down towards the front of that pelvis, into towards that that femur, and the iliacus kind of comes in contact with it, and then it wraps around to some other muscles along the outside of that leg as well, too. They're all working together, okay? From that diaphragm upward, there are other muscles that coordinate with that movement as well, too. And those are also part of another chain of muscles that will orient itself into a different direction. These have names. I'm actually, just for the sake of time and not trying to confuse too many people, I'm not even going to get into the names of them today.
I'll
talk specifically about some of the muscles that I think are going to be powerful things for people to kind of consider and begin to look at when they're working with their clients or when they're working with their patients. So every time they go to inhale, the pelvis is being pulled to the right because of that strong pull of the right diaphragm. The left diaphragm is trying to do its best that it possibly can as well, too, to keep up, but it's just not quite as strong and coordinated as that right side. So it's going to start to get work in a little bit of a dysfunctional way. It's going to get pulled and stretched a little bit. It can become hypertonic. The right can be tonic and strong. The left can be tonic and weak, for example. It's kind of like if you have a muscle that's just overtoned, other muscles are going to have a tendency to be long and on. You've heard those expressions before for some people. Just doing too much work, but it's not able to do it in a very effective way. That's what will happen on that left side. So then if that left diaphragm is getting in that position and it's trying to do whatever it possibly can to help out to counter that right side activity, it's going to pull from that left psoas. Now the left psoas will begin to kind of become overactive. So now it's going to start to do too much work in terms of its activity because it's trying to counter the pull of what's happening on that opposite side. Okay? So again, we got that person standing. The inhale, the pelvis begins to rotate back to the right a little bit. That psoas is saying, whoa, 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 get back here. You're good. I don't want you going that far. So it becomes tonic. It becomes overactive. The iliacus begins to join that party. So now you've got a pelvis rotating back on the right and anteriorly tipping on that left side and rotating forward because of the pull of that left psoas. You with me?
Middle
of the body. So whatever's happening on one side, something else has to be going on the opposite side.
I do have a question for you, though. I mean, we have all this stuff going on, and you know, I got to ask, when maybe what's the best way to ask this? So in general, when do we start, or when do you start seeing this in your profession starting to affect people? Is there a certain age range where after all this, you know, ineffective breathing patterns catch up to us and start causing issues? Or is it just a case where, you know, you have someone that starts going into an athletic environment, a sport, where they start having overuse on one side where, you know, everything just starts coming together where everything falls apart?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And the challenging part is that there is no one answer for that because there's so many variables.
Exactly.
You know, you're going to have a baseball player who hits right-handed, who throws right-handed, who's going to be doing stuff in a very consistent, rotationally oriented direction over and over and over again. And they started with Little League. Actually, they started when they could pick up that rock and throw it because they realized, holy cow, that's a really cool thing to do. I mean, I think of my son when he was young, he just couldn't stop throwing stuff.
I think that was all of us.
Exactly. And that's just, and that's, so that creates some degree of a pattern for that person. It drives it. So what about a left-handed person? Well, you know what? Neurologically, let's talk about the brain a little bit. Well, let's not, but the brain will help to influence that stuff. know, how does your brain process the information it's receiving from its outside environment? Mm-hmm. Did it realize early on that just the way that their house was set up, or that their father was left-handed, or that, you know, their orientation of their system, or either maybe in their visual system, kind of coordinated them to be able to do that into their left side?
Mm-hmm.
Or their body realized, you know what, I've got this really strong inside pull. It's happening in my subconscious. I don't know what's going on, but I got to see what I can do to try and help to balance that. I got to figure out a way to balance this.
Gotcha.
And that's what we'll see as well too.
Do you and with like say you have someone that is an untrained person, never played sports growing up, and just lived their life maybe with very little activity, if any. Are there certain cases where you can see a trend where, you know, people when they start getting to that, whether it be puberty or whether they're like in their 20s and they start that desk job, where you start seeing these ineffective breathing patterns, you know, pop up? Or is it just, it's kind of always happening from the get-go? We just kind of forget how to breathe properly, and you see a lot of those people that are just, you know, breathing with their shoulders.
You know, I think going back to what I had alluded to earlier, you know, one of the things that I think is an important clarification I should probably say now, you know, I'm on here to talk about PRI,
yeah,
because, you know, obviously that's what we're discussing about, but that doesn't mean that the postural restoration and its assessments and its treatment interventions and things like that doesn't recognize that someone might have like a hypermobility syndrome. Someone might have a little bit of a genetic disorder. Someone might actually have just, soft tissue stuff that's a little bit different, or their neurological issue. There's a lot of little things that will feed into and create problems for other people. That being said, my observations over the course of many, many years has been that the way that the Institute has established assessments and interventions, it is my baseline that I go with. It's what I call a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, absolutely, I will see that sometimes it's being driven by the fact that they sat at a desk really early on as a child, and they had heavy backpacks, and it put them into a really crummy position.
Yeah.
And their susceptibility due to just some of the other aforementioned things that I kind of alluded to might have fed into that.
Okay.
I'm dealing with a girl now who's, I see all kinds of stuff, but I'm dealing with a girl just this morning, for example, who's bilateral numbness in her hands. She's a junior in high school. She's a high school athlete. She has had every single workup known to man to try and figure out what's producing bilateral numbness into her hands and in her forearms. And she is what we call kind of stuck in this extended pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Her rib cage is completely restricted. She has really poor, poor airflow. She has, just this general, a poor quality movement in terms of how she walks and how she stands, and you know, everything's kind of floppy, and she doesn't really she's really active in her sport and is really good at it, but she doesn't have the inherent makeup to be able to do stuff that's going to allow her to be able to do it well and safely, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
So what she's done is then she's taken that whole system and created so much stability through her inhalation. Do you know what I mean? That now she has all of this tissue tone around her thorax that's putting all this pressure up into her upper brachial plexus and all of her vascular structures that come out of her head and her neck.
Oh, wow.
And when we get her, we get her to kind of do the things that she's supposed to do and go through some treatment interventions, she's like, no, that actually helps. You know, I talked to her today about her walking. And again, you know, PRI is gait.
Mm-hmm.
And your ability to be able to kind of move evenly from one side to the other, with the same kind of movement and your arms opposite, being able to reciprocally move in coordination with that opposite leg freely, smoothly, and evenly as much as possible. And she's a great example of someone who walked and her arms just kind of hung by her sides, and they were both kind of bilaterally internally rotated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, is that someone who could look at that and talk about it saying, well, you know what, she has restricted thorax, she has, she got to get on a foam roller. She got really tight neck muscles or scalenes. Absolutely. And she's been to two other PT places and got a lot of the other really good quality intervention strategies that you would do in that particular situation, but she's not any better. So, you know, sometimes you have to kind of look a little bit deeper and recognize that there's some stuff that that has to do with how the Institute has established more optimal positioning of the thorax through the breathing activities, as well as how they look at that ability to have things move more evenly side to side, and then how to integrate a intervention protocol that helps to balance that out better. There are few to no exercises that I do on one side of the body that I do on the other side of the body the same way. When in particular, if I'm dealing with someone who has these imbalances that are pretty significant, because the body already has that hardwired that way. So, for example, when I go back to that initial picture of that person and standing that I discussed before, you know, if I do activities that are assuming the body to be even, but yet we're working in a position where you have overactivity of muscles on one side versus the other, and I get them upright and start them doing squats right away, or put them under load too quickly, that might produce some issues. Will a lot of people in the fitness industry be able to kind of have them move through things well through FMS screening, through their assessments, through doing some foam rolling? Will they be able to kind of teach them really good deadlifting patterns and squat stuff, even though they have this underlying thing? Absolutely. Absolutely. And will some people be able to compensate through it and do okay? Sure, absolutely. But if you've got people who are susceptible to problems and you're pushing them through that that type of an activity when their system can't do it, then that's where things are going to be vulnerable to breaking down. So that's why they feel like we feel like it's an important component to understand some of the assessments that are out there that the Institute has established to try to figure out, are you really stuck? Mm-hmm. What I mean? Are there some corrective things we need to get you into a better position so that you can start better? And then from there, be able to kind of build you into a more balanced program.
Got it.
So from the standpoint of where the breathing starts, the reason we talk so much about the breathing piece is because if you got dysfunctional breathing, it's going to be hard to have people move into the right position. Mm-hmm. So we talked about that a little bit last time and talked about how to kind of introduce a couple of breathing activities to try and get things to work better. Well, then from that component, if someone has a real rotational imbalance, then some of the what they call repositioning activities that the Institute has, that a lot of people, I think, who have heard anything about PRI are familiar with, where people are in this position on their back and their feet are on a wall, they've got a ball between their legs, or they're doing an activity where they actually have a balloon in their mouth, or they're doing a combination of an activity with a balloon in their mouth and their feet on a wall and things like that, is to try and really retrain that system to have all of those muscles work more effectively and in conjunction with one another so that they can get into this more balanced state more effectively so that the body can move, again, as we talked about, kind of reciprocally side to side as they're going through their daily activities.
Gotcha.
So what does the balloon do that people talk about? And that's where a lot of people equate PRI with the balloon. Mm-hmm. There's a great article that was put out by Kenny Boyle that really describes that in depth, and it does a really nice job of discussing the influence that it has on that system. But what it basically does is in summation, is it provides great feedback for the body to be able to use to be able to have all those muscles work more effectively, so that the system can be able to find that sense of balance better. If I go and I go to bend my elbow, I use the bicep a lot as an analogy. I hope you appreciate that. I got to bend my elbow up against gravity. It's giving me just a little bit of feedback. But if I put just a little bit of resistance on there, it's going to have better feedback. My bicep's going to have a better idea of what it needs to do. Fair to say? So because of the fact that we're trying to teach people through some of the breath training how to exhale better and more effectively, the balloon provides great feedback to the system to be able to give it some resistance to blow into. So as you're blowing into the balloon and the air is pushing back in as it hits the walls of the balloon, that's giving some resistance. So it's allowing those exhalation muscles to do a better job of doing what they're supposed to do. The reason the Institute has people do stuff with the feet on the wall, some of those what they call repositioning activities, is to try and target the muscles that need to counter the overactivity of some of the muscles that I talked about previously. that left psoas, that hyperactive or imbalanced diaphragm on the right versus that left side, the overactive right adductor muscles and internal rotators that are overactive because the position of that pelvis on that right side is, again, being pulled into that position. And so as that orients itself towards that right side and those muscles become active, then other muscles on the left side will have to try and compensate. So with a ball between their legs and their feet on a wall and lifting their hips up, and they can do this with a balloon in their mouth, as some of the exercise sheets show about, what they're doing is they're working on a gentle squeeze of the ball to activate the adductors. Mm-hmm. And I cue people to think about using the left ones a little bit more. They're pulling their feet on the wall to scoop their hips up so that they're activating the upper hamstrings, which helps to pull that pelvis underneath them to be in a better position for things to work more effectively. Again, you're countering the activity of that psoas, in particular on that left side, and iliac is doing too much work. And then as they do that with the breathing activities, now they have that nice resistance of that airflow into the balloon to allow those muscles to work a little bit more effectively as they go through that breathing cycle.
So for people out there, we actually did get a question that I forgot to bring up to you last time, is that when we were talking about the breathing stuff, when is the best time to do it? Is it, you know, before you do anything? If you're going to go in and go lift today, you're going to go train, is it the first thing that you do once you get ready to, you know, warm up and stuff like that? Or, you know, should you put it in before you lift? Like, where's the best place to put all the breathing?
In all fairness, Kevin, I think if you ask three different practitioners, they get three different answers. And I think that, you know what I mean? I mean, I think they're all right.
I'm going to ask you, you're my pro, you're the guy that I'm going to. What would you do with your athletes when they come in?
I liken, you know, Tony Gentilcore did a nice job of writing something up recently. I was down in Eric Kresge's place a couple weeks ago doing an in-service down there, which is great. It's just, there's just such a great group down there. And Tony wrote a nice kind of piece on it, and kind of what I like in the breath training that too. And he did a nice job of kind of saying, look, I don't have all day to spend on breathing. I don't have all day. My clients don't want it. My classes don't want it. And I get that piece. However, I liken it to teaching someone about, you know, scap positioning. You know what I mean? Like, if you're doing stuff and you're teaching people how to orient their rib cage on the front in a better position, if you're teaching people to kind of get their scapula to be able to kind of rest on the rib cage in the right position so that they're doing what you want it to do during any of the training that they're doing, that's something that goes with a little bit of education. You spend a little bit of time the first couple times you're working with them to teach them that, okay? It's the same type of thing with breathing. There's kind of, in the early stages of working with someone, you got to spend a little time teaching them how to do stuff so that they can pull back into that when you cue them on it down the road. So once you spend a little bit of time going through it, then what I think is a good idea is to have people at least get the good air exchange they need during their warm-up. If you have people coming in and they're spending time on a bike, or they're spinning on an Airdyne, or they're doing some type of dynamic active warm-up, I'm cueing them to keep their airflow going pretty consistently. I will oftentimes at least like to fire those muscles just a little bit. I do not expect people to walk around and train in a system that's quote unquote neutral all the time. Mm-hmm. Because it's just, they don't know how to function with it well enough to be able to do it under load. Mm-hmm. They need a little bit of that imbalance so that things can be into a position where they're going to be able to create some degree of stability for the task at hand. And if they're in that position where they're kind of able to have too much loosey-goosey stuff going on, then what's going to happen is that they're going to be vulnerable to not having things work optimally. So I'll have them do a little bit of airflow activity at the beginning during the dynamic warm-up. If we're doing a heavier activity where they're doing more weighted loading activities and things like that, halfway, two-thirds of the way through, I'll get them on their hands and knees. I'll have them round out their back. I'll have them do some breaths in that position just to get that back to open up just a little bit. As they're doing nice, slow, full breaths, and they're getting a nice, full exhalation, and they're getting that deep abdominal wall and those pelvic muscles to activate in that rounded quadruped position, you know, like they're getting nice abdominal wall activation, I'll have them do that again, absolutely. I think it's a good way to try and allow a little bit of active stretch to take place and deep stabilizer activity to be able to help to supplement what you're doing. Then get them back up and have them go on to the next task at hand. Gotcha. I think that people being able to do something towards the end of a session as well, too, just to find those muscles so they can walk out of it pretty safely is good.
Mm-hmm.
2-3 minutes at the end. I like to have people get on their back, stick a ball between their legs, do some hip lifting, have them find their hamstrings, have them find their deep adductors, cue them a little bit to think about the left side a little bit more than their right, just to turn that on. They do a couple sets of that just to kind of get that to work pretty well. I'll probably have them doing some type of, depending upon the class, I'll have them do some type of upright, you know, backward walking or crawling on hands and knees, super slow, just something to kind of simulate some degree of reciprocal activity towards the end, just to get their system to be able to kind of get up, to be able to leave in a nice alternating active way.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So I think that doing those types of things is a great way to introduce kind of the before, during, and then after workout routine. That being said, I don't know that using balloons in the gym is the best way to kind of go about keeping clients. Okay? I love balloons. They're fantastic tools. And if you want to get someone to be able to develop good, powerful breath strength, teach them to use a balloon. And if you can get your facility to feel comfortable having certain people use that as becoming the norm, I think it's fantastic. But it's going to take some work on a facility's part to feel comfortable going down that road to be able to introduce that as a training tool concept before it'll be widely accepted as the new norm. With respect to your activities that you teach people to do, the thing that you want to think about is that some people, as you watch them, you know, doing you know, cable pulls, or they're doing pressings, or they're doing pull down things like that, you'll see that people have a tendency to kind of, again, pull and orient and rotate themselves a certain way. And so the activities that the Institute puts together to try and work on correcting those positions are really great ways to have people on their own outside of the facility to be able to kind of keep things in check.
Mm-hmm.
So by that I mean, much like my patients, I expect them to do their homework. I think it's an important component that if you have someone who might need a little bit of extra work as a client of yours to show them some things that they should do on their own at home, I think is a very fair way to, a very fair expectation of your clients. Look, yeah. I want to get the best out of your workouts. In order to do that, here's what I've identified as a couple things that really need a little bit of your extra attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to have you take your time, and I want to have you do these two activities or these three activities on your own at home. You can do them here if you want to get here early when you get here to warm up or get those muscles active. If you find that that's better for you, I'm okay with that. But I want you to take the time outside of our training, that, you know what I mean, to have you do these activities that I think will really be helpful to have you keep your body into a little bit more of a balanced state.
Got it. Cool.
So, if someone has a propensity to, I'll go back to that standing man again, that, imagine that person, if you will. So if someone has a propensity to orient themselves towards that right side, when you're doing training programs with people, there are certain muscles that will be very vulnerable to overactivity. What that produces, it produces imbalance of joints. The joints in particular that can become a problem are things such as your ball and socket joints of your hips, your ball and socket joints of your shoulders, certainly your ribs, certainly knees. You know, a lot of those joints are vulnerable to being malpositioned or not optimally joint centration. They're not optimally lined up. A couple of the assessments that are really very valuable that the Institute has established as good tools to determine if these joints are lined up well, I use all day long with every patient I see because they let me know how that person's functioning. So there's an assessment that many people learn in school called the Ober test, which is one that people do on their side. Are you familiar with it at all, Kevin?
Yes, and I apologize for the long muted pause as Trucks always come by when I do podcasts, and I apologize if it shows up in the audio. I'm doing my best to mute myself, though.
I think I had a text come in, so I think I went ding ding as well. So that's all right, not a problem. Didn't throw me off.
Fair enough.
So, this overtest was an assessment that's done on your side where you bend their legs and you bring the leg up and you bring it around in line with the body and then you bring it down to try and figure out if there's quote unquote IP band tightness. It was developed decades ago by a surgeon, frankly, and he used it actually to turn with so many back surgery, but it had been adapted as something that people use for IP band tightness.
Wow, no way.
But what we've learned and what the Institute has established quite brilliantly, and as far as I'm concerned, is it's a positional assessment. So sure, you put them on their side and you bring their leg up and you bring it in line with the body and you try to bring it down towards a table or adduct it. And if you palpated that IT band, it'll be tight. If it doesn't go to the table, it'll feel tight. But that's not due to the IT band's quote-unquote tightness. But what it has to do with is it's a malposition of that ball not able to rotate freely inside the socket, or the femoral head being able to roll into the acetabulum in the way that it's supposed to. It gets hung up. It gets hung up on the bottom of that socket. So that inferior aspect of that acetabulum and labrum is pinching on the bottom of that ball. That's what it's telling me. So that lets me know if someone comes in and they lie on one side, and I assess that to just figure out if the leg goes down to the table. Does it go down on one side as well as it goes down onto the other side? And what I find in many, many, many people is that the right goes down really very well, and the left does not go down well, or not nearly as well as the right side does.
Mm-hmm.
That lets me know that pelvis is in a position of torque. Okay? That is one identifying factor of whether that person is in that pattern that we discussed a little bit earlier. Again, that psoas pulling that left pelvis forward a little bit, not allowing that femur to rest optimally inside that socket because the psoas attaches right to the femur. So that malposition lets me know, oh, okay, well, if I'm going to have you do a bunch of squats, and you go down, and you're going halfway down, and you start to kind of get stiff or tight, get pressure in your knee, or, you know what, you're doing a full squat, and you actually feel okay, but I'm watching you get down, and you get that kind of classic, quote-unquote, butt wink that everybody seems to be kind of talking about and writing about as well, too. You know, a lot of times, that's also a component of the fact that you got rotation of the pelvis taking place,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not able to freely, evenly rotate posteriorly on both sides the way that it's supposed to. And if you plot them on the table and you take a look at that, you'll probably find that there's a little bit of a difference side to side. It's not uncommon for people, too, to lie down on one side and neither leg goes down to the table well. That's indicative of another pattern that the Institute has identified. Those are people who have overactivity of their back muscles. That's many of your people who do a lot of strength stuff in your gym. It's what they call a posterior-exterior chain, or what we call a PEC, meaning that their muscles on their back, their lats, their erector spinae, all these muscles are so toned up
mm-hmm.
that they've kind of tipped that pelvis forward and oriented in a way that both of those balls are sitting forward in the sockets, and they're not able to optimally position themselves well. So then neither leg will be able to go down to the table.
And this is for, like, reference. Like, you actually, in one of the in-services that you did at MBSC, you did this on a couple of our staff, and we had some one who's a former, fantastic, absolutely fantastic lacrosse player, who is a fantastic athlete, who you popped up on the table and immediately started seeing major issues when you were doing this test, like major discrepancies or asymmetries between sides. So, but that's not something you'll just see in people that are athletes. You'll see this in basically everyone. You'll see a big asymmetry from side to side of the IT band.
You know, you remember that too, Kevin. I remember the person you're talking about.
Well, it's because this is when some of the magic started coming into play. Like what I call magic, just because, you know, you see someone come into the facility not knowing anything about what PRI is. You know, I think we might have come in once before that too, but still not having a great idea of what it's all about. And then starting to see major changes in patterns by just doing something for like 3 minutes. And, you know, I'll let you jump back in.
No, that's okay. No, I appreciate you saying something. Thanks. I'll say this real quickly. This is something that I do say, and it's the truth. So when I took my first course in whatever 2001 and left and was, again, had my world shaken, and was really trying to figure out what this was all about. What I did was, before I even knew what I was doing, I started assessing everybody that kind of would come through. So, in the clinic where I work, I do like this, what they call the adduction drop test, which is that test that I described. Or I'd check shoulder rotations based upon how the Institute describes, internal rotation, what they call humeral glenoid internal rotation. And I was saying to myself, I'm like, daggone it, they're right. This thing is just, it is such a dominant pattern that I literally spent the first year or two trying to disprove it. I remember Ron saying to me, if you see this, and this, call me. I'll come and look at it myself with you, because it's not there.
Yeah.
Unless they've had significant trauma, of some kind and things like that, that's really knocked things into a different position.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was when I started realizing, this pattern is actually really very, very true. And then through the following couple of years of taking more coursework, and playing with the repositioning activities and honing my skills, I became to have a better understanding about what those tests were actually really truly showing me and how often I'll use them now to try and figure out, more things than just, is the joint in a good position? I wrote a paper recently, it's like 4 pages, that talks about that one test. And it's on the Posture Restoration website. I have it underneath my name in there under find a provider type of thing. It's 4 pages to talk about all of the different ways that you can get information from what that one assessment provides.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not being too, being all out there and esoteric. It's really valid information. And it kind of gives you a lot of input in a very short period of time about what's going on with this structure and how what we call patterned the individual actually is. So some of the things that I'll have people do, as some of the other assessments I'll have people do too, is lie them on their back and check that, what I call that humeral glenoid internal rotation, where you're moving the humerus on the glenoid fossa into internal rotation. They're on their back, their arm is out to the side, putting a little bit of pressure on the anterior aspect of the shoulder, rotating it down, seeing does it fully rotate down to the table? Because for the most part, it should. Again, as a general rule, if someone's, I'll just say thorax isn't optimally positioned and their system has too much pressure in it, or what we call hyperinflated, then that shoulder is not going to go down to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as you talked about that's when the magic started. We pushed on the rib cage, we got people to breathe a little bit differently, and those shoulders will start to rotate and they will completely change their position and orientation because of you just influencing what truly needed to be influenced, which is joint position, more than just putting them into a position where you're going to stretch them into internal rotation or give them a sleeper stretch or something like that. I'm not trying to suggest that if people do that stuff, that that's all wrong. I'm just trying to say that there's many times another way to go about doing things that might be a little bit more effective in terms of carryover and potentially be a little less likely to overstretch a joint or tissue inside the area.
Got it. Oh, sorry. I apologize for jumping in, but this is the point of the show where I like to give a shout out to the people that are supporting the show, the Patreons out there that are donating certain money values for the production of each episode of the show. So I want to give a shout out to Christy Shaw, one of our Patreons. And you can do this by going to patreon.com/thefitcast. And again, there's right now about 100 Patreons, so 100 of you out there that are listening to the show are supporting it, thinking that this is something that is worth making sure that new episodes come out every week. And you'll see, since we started, haven't missed an episode. I've been able to turn this to kind of into a job for myself and for this. So if you do enjoy the show, I really hope you'll jump over there. And like, literally a lot of people are given like $1 per episode. Like, so if you want to think of it as like a 99 cent per episode, or think of the iTunes model for that stuff, I'd really appreciate it if you could jump on there and you can help me continue to get great people like Michael Mullen on the show to talk about all these great topics from fitness to nutrition to rehab. So thank you, yeah, to everyone out there. And Christy, you are our Patreon of the week. So this is the first episode we're doing that. Just want to say thank you to all you guys out there. All right, sorry, Michael, I apologize.
Excellent. No, you're fine.
Those guys are the best. This show wouldn't even be happening anymore after episode 300 if people didn't step up and help out. We just hope the support continues going forward.
Absolutely. Thank you, Christy, as well. Yeah, these are your sponsors. Absolutely.
Totally, yeah.
So what I want to do now, I there's so many different directions, as we talked about before we went on air.
Yeah, I know.
Go with Kevin, that I just wanted to kind of at least kind of introduce some of the other concepts, because I think that for people who listen to this, there's going to be some people who are like, yeah, I knew all that stuff that he talked about. And I think there were some people are kind of like, oh, wow, that's interesting.
We got the smartest audience in the world, I guess. Wow.
That's just, well, you know, it's walking that line. You know, when I do these lectures, sometimes I'll be kind of like, all right, who has any exposure to this at all?
Yeah, you can't really have the podcast audience raise their hand for this. So
exactly. It lets me know how the facial recognition, and I'm like, okay, I got to go over that topic a little bit more again. I'm trying to split the middle as much as I possibly can, but I do want to at least address a couple of the questions that people pose, because they took the time to at least ask some questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
One of them was, you know, how to specifically address and identify QL dysfunction, mm-hmm. also how to separate between psoas and iliac dysfunction. And, you know, as with most things, there's a real complexity with some of the answers. The easiest way that I'll describe the QL and what the quadratus lumborum does in, well, let's just say in this pattern, is that when a muscle is not able to do what it's supposed to do, then something else has to take over that job. Okay. So let's just talk about the person that has that torqued position that we described. So as they go to step from one foot to the other, and during that swing phase, as that leg is swinging through the air just before it hits the ground, and as ground contact happens, there are certain series of muscles that are supposed to contract at a certain time. And it's a little bit different on one side than it is on the other if someone's stuck in this rotated position. So as I'm standing on my left leg and swinging my right leg, just as that right leg hits the ground, my muscles have to decelerate that swing. My hamstrings and glute muscles should be turning on to aid in that shock absorption that's supposed to happen as my foot hits the ground, so that as my left leg lifts to swing through, they're active for stabilization. When people are in this torqued or rotated position and are unable to effectively do things evenly side to side, as that right foot hits the ground, because of the posterior rotation of that pelvis on the right side, the hamstring becomes much more dominant in its activity to help, I'll just say, take on the role of what the glute is supposed to do. The glute has a couple of different functions. It's a hip extensor. It's a hip rotator. So it's got to take on different roles in different planes of motion. On that right side, when people are in this pattern, it kind of dumbs itself down. It doesn't work as much. The position alone almost functions like the glute. So as that foot hits the ground, if the glute's not going to do the job, it's going to go up a little higher. And that task is going to be taken on by the quadratus lumborum, for example. So for people who go to step into that position, if they've got, quote unquote, no glute on that side, then as they go to step into that position, that quadratus lumborum is going to be that next muscle further up the chain to try and help to take on that task and take on that role, because they're doing it in a position that's going to allow that to take place better. If these are people who are in that kind of that, what I call that PEC pattern I talked about, who are just overextended, mm-hmm. overlordotic, extensor tone too much, they got no butt on both sides. Both butts are shut off. So then they got bilateral QL that function, again, kind of like the glute will. So the dysfunction in and of itself is because of compensation. And so you can go in and you can roll it and you can scrape it and you can massage it and do positional release and all that great stuff. And it will be, you know, stuff that people will do with some degree of success. But if you're not retraining it so that the sequencing is proper, it's not going to hold. And that's what's the more important part with respect to what the quadratus lumborum needs to be inhibited from doing more, in particular on one side versus the other, unless they're in this, again, this bilateral position.
I think you should coin the term bilateral butt shutdown. I think that's like a great technical term. I just like, I would love to walk into a conference. I like perform better with 300 people in the room. Like, yeah, it's, you know, it's just bilateral butt shutdown. It's why QLs are, you know, overacting. So we got overactive. So we got to, you know, try to figure out a way to fix that.
BBSD syndrome.
Oh, I yes. Like, all right.
And I'll coin you. I'll trademark you on that one, Kevin. Definitely.
You can take that. I want to see it on like the PRI website or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Brett Contreras would have a field day with that one. Absolutely.
Totally. Yeah.
So with respect to the psoas and the iliac assist function, how to separately between the psoas and iliac function, you know, they function so similarly in the pattern. And again, time restraints being what they are, that psoas is attaching to your spine and the iliac is attaching to your ilium. So they, even though they attach roughly around the same spot along that trochanter of the femur, you know, you have one that's influencing spine position and you have one that's influencing pelvis position. So the contractile qualities of that psoas, as it's overactive on the left side in that rotated pattern, that psoas, again, will also get, I'm sorry, the iliacus will also get into that position where it becomes overactive. It's going to join the party. It's going to help to pull and continue to orient that pelvis into that anteriorly tipped position along with the psoas. They're both yanking on it. One's yanking on the spine, rotating the lumbar spine to the right. One's yanking on the pelvis, orienting that pelvis in a forward position, both of which are pulling on that femur anteriorly on that left side. So with respect to differentiation, the biggest piece is your ability to be able to work on inhibition of the iliacus and psoas on that left side. Again, if they're in that really rotated position, or when they're really in that rotated position. Again, if they're in that PEC, well, then it's most likely they got both of them doing too much work. And then again, you want to work on trying to reduce that overactivity of those extensor muscles to get them out of that overextended position. Because what's going to happen once they get out of that overextended position is that now they're in that rotated pattern. Does that make sense? So if you've got someone who has that PEC and they're in that overextended position, once you take them out of that and you're able to reduce that overdominance of those back extensors, they're going to fall into place like everybody else, mm-hmm. which is going to be in that rotated position. So what we work on first with some of those people is to get their body to be able to not be that quite as much extensor tone, get an abdominal wall working better, get them to learn to exhale better so they get out of that overextension. Then what you're left with is that rotation that you have to subsequently work on cleaning up afterwards. So I hope I didn't lose people with that one.
No, this is stuff coming from the audience, and it is you know, super common issue.
Absolutely. And even with some people, you know, even if you're just kind of starting with phase one, which is just doing some of the breathing stuff that we talked about and getting people to reduce their or improve their positions so that the other muscles can do a better job of doing what they're supposed to do, that's what matters most.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what's going to be the starting point. Then at least as you become better educated about some of the things that matter with respect to addressing that torque and that rotation, that's where it really starts to get interesting, because being able to get those people out of that torque and have them learn to be able to do things more evenly side to side, you'd be surprised, much like you mentioned, the magic that can produce in terms of people's movement quality and their sense of balance. Their whole sense of balance is better. So another question, after strength training, what is your favorite drill for getting athletes out of extension and started on the recovery process? We addressed that a little bit. You know, we talked about how, you know, afterwards or towards the middle or two thirds of the way through a session, I'll have people doing stuff on all fours, you know, rounding out their back and doing some breathing in that position. I think it's a great way to kind of get their system to get good positioning, good air exchange again. Again, I might have them do a couple things in 90-90 position on the back towards the end of a session, or doing some crawling activities, again, just to kind of get all those little muscles to be able to learn to have them be able to move pretty evenly side to side and pretty comfortably. Someone else had posted a question as well too, Kevin. Let me see if I can kind of pull this up real quick.
Yeah, I actually got it. The Twitter question?
Yeah.
Yes. This was from the normalist, so we'll see what we can do with this. What's the left hamstring of the neck, and what's the 90-90 version of the thorax?
So I guess what I'll say with respect to the left hamstring of the neck, I mean, I will lose a lot of people if I go down this road. So all due respect, you know, I don't know that getting too much into the pterygoid and the importance of that that muscle in particular being able to help with positioning the cranium optimally on top of the cervical spine is something that I feel I should get into, but I would happily have that conversation at another time. But with respect to the 90-90 version of the thorax, what the person's asking is they're saying, you know, what activity would be good to try and address not just pelvis correction, but thorax correction? So by 90-90 position, they're talking about on their back with their knees bent and the feet on the wall. So what would be the good one to do for the thorax? Well, 90-90 position is a good one to do for the thorax as well, too, but that would be one that you would begin to do with a balloon, for example. Because if you do a 90-90 hip lift with a balloon, you're going to be able to get a lot more activity taking place that's going to influence the diaphragm from above as well. You're going to get a little bit more muscle activity and a little bit better correction. Doing stuff where there's an activity we do on the left side where you know, people are on their left side and they slide their right thigh forward and they lift their right leg up and then they lift their left leg up. But that's a nice activity for developing a lot of control when they do it correctly to tie together the thoracic area with the pelvic area and to be able to work on those corrective strategies. Again, hard to describe without being able to kind of visualize it or be able for me to show it. But you know, those are some activities that I think are good versions of things that you can do to try and influence the thorax as well with respect to what he's asking. You know, certainly anything that works on reaching, because I think that as a general rule, most of us have a tendency to do a lot of pulling activities, in particular at the gym. So there's a lot of stuff that people will do with cable pulls and rowing sequences and pull downs and things like that. And except for you, Kevin, who will bench whenever he possibly can and do a lot of pressing, part of the pressing has to do with being able to do things that incorporate reach. Mm-hmm. So more than just a press, what we're trying to have people learn to do better is be able to reach. Because what the reaching does is it works on a better position of the thorax and the scapula so that they can do a better job of integrating with each other so that you can get better quality position, again, of that thorax area above the level of the diaphragm, which is ultimately what we're looking to do. So having people doing stuff on their back where they're in 90-90 position and then reaching an arm. Having people, again, on all fours, rounding their back, pushing into the table or the floor at the same time. Is again, working on getting that reaching pattern going to be able to get better movement quality so that you're balancing off the thorax with the pelvis at the same time. Again, that is probably more for people who have a little bit of a good understanding of the PRI teachings, but I at least wanted to address that on air since they were kind enough to ask a question, to pose a question.
Totally, and since I know we're kind of running out of time, but this is going to be my preemptive invitation to come back on and to continue talking about this stuff, just because you know, even when coming out to MBSC with a room full of strength and conditioning coaches, you know, it does take a couple times to start, you know, getting all this stuff to click. So you know, let's let people digest that. And I want you guys to, you know, the audience out there, I'm going to put this on you to come back with some more questions or some follow-up stuff and make sure that, you know, you're getting all your questions answered when it comes to this. And maybe we'll plan for, it's a nice round number, you know, 5 or 6 weeks from now to do another one and talk a little bit more about this stuff. How does that sound?
That sounds great. You know, certainly, you know, there are other sources people can go to in the meantime. Again, the Postural Restoration's website has just a whole bunch of information on it that people can access and read a little bit about. There are, you know, YouTube videos and clips that people can access that go through some of the activities that, that I was describing as well. So people can kind of pull some of that stuff as well. I certainly would answer any questions anybody would want to send me via, via email. I think I said it last time, but my email is mmullin, M-U-L-L-I-N, at orthoassociates.com. Certainly you can access me through Twitter, which is MJMATC. I certainly would answer those as well, too. And what I'll probably plan on doing next time, Kevin, is I'll probably get into a little bit more of the true, naming and describing the chains a little bit more, because that's an important part of the conversation that we describe as with the Institute, so that people can really begin to kind of understand the influence of the muscles that much more, and what each of them actually that will do on one side of the body versus the other side of the body.
Cool. Perfect. Yeah, that sounds great.
Can I do one last plug too?
Absolutely. Yeah, of course.
Great. And in February, the Institute has ongoing courses. They have a ton of really quality stuff. This weekend right now is their annual symposium called Advanced Integration. And this is for people who have taken at least a couple of the primary courses. And, some of the names in the industry I know are there. So, I know Kevin Neal's there, that couple's there, Lance Goyke's there out of IFAST, out of Indiana. I know Bill Hartman had planned on going. So there's some people who are really trying to really embrace this and gain a better understanding of what it's all about and starting to implement it nationwide, which is awesome. So I really encourage people to consider taking a course or even a home study course that the Institute offers too, because it really will go a lot more in depth and give a better description and background and understanding of some of the stuff that I talked about. As well as the fact that, again, as I mentioned, I'm doing a couple of one-day programs in February that will incorporate, a couple of the different courses and give a little bit more of a generalist overview and at least some practical tools to start with if people are interested in taking some of those.
Awesome. I would definitely recommend people go and see this stuff in person if this is, intriguing you because, things are always, a picture is 1,000 words and video or being live is many more than that, I guess. I don't know. That's a bad analogy, but so make sure you definitely check all that stuff out. And I would highly recommend you do follow Mike on Twitter. There's always interesting stuff being posted on there. And the PRI, Postural Restoration Institute, is also on Twitter, and they're posting cool stuff too at PostreStinst. So you can grab them as well. And for everyone else out there, I hope you're subscribing to the show on iTunes. If you do enjoy it, I'd love if you would submit a review on there. And again, if you aren't a Patreon yet, I really hope you consider it. We've had some people drop off in the last couple weeks. So, of course I'm getting a phone call from my dad right now. So I'm going to wrap this one up, and we will see you everyone next time. Mike, thank you so much. And we'll talk to you soon.